It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
I've had people come in and say, I didn't qualify for HAMP, and I read their hardship letter, and it sounds like... I say, you sound like you can't qualify to get up in the morning. You know, they're so... pitiful, and the lender's not looking for that.
Private attorney Karen Kennedy discusses forensic mortgage loan and securitization audits and the surprising foreclosure defenses that result from them in the second part of a two-part presentation. And during this week's question and answer session, we talk about what tenants can do to get their landlords to deal with a troublesome tenant neighbor. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 98, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. Earlier this month, the Internal Revenue Service discontinued a service that aided banks in making high-cost refund anticipation loans to the working poor. The service, called the Debt Indicator, helps banks that partner with tax preparers to make loans based on the borrower's expected tax refund. The Debt Indicator acts like a credit check and tells tax preparers whether a refund will be paid or will be intercepted for government debts. Refund anticipation loans are 1 to 2 week loans made by banks and facilitated by commercial tax preparers secured by the taxpayer's refund. These loans can be expensive, with some lenders charging annual percentage rates of 50% to nearly 500%. They expose taxpayers to unmanageable debt if a problem with a refund results in the loan being unpaid. The National Consumer Law Center and the Consumer Federation of America have been urging the IRS to end the Debt Indicator since 2005, arguing that the federal government should not be sharing taxpayers' personal information for the profit of banks and tax preparers by operating what is essentially a free credit reporting service for them. The IRS finally has agreed. In other news, the IRS also announced that it will explore the idea of permitting a portion of tax refunds to go directly to pay for tax preparation. This idea could help undercut the market for refund anticipation loans and a related non-loan product, refund anticipation checks. Some taxpayers use these loans and checks to avoid paying out of pocket for the fees for tax preparation. By splitting refunds to the taxpayer and the tax preparer, one of the incentives to pay for refund anticipation loans and refund anticipation checks could be eliminated. In January of this year, the IRS commissioner announced another reform backed by consumer groups, regulation of tax preparers. In the future, the IRS will require tax preparers to be registered, tested, and adhere to a code of ethics. Finally, consumer advocates called on the IRS and banking regulators to end refund anticipation loans once and for all. They urged the IRS to alter its privacy rules to prohibit tax preparers from sharing or using tax return information to sell or arrange financial products, which would stop the sale of high-cost, risky loans and deposit products. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
It's time for the answer to our weekly quiz called, Is That Legal? Last week, we gave you a legal question and three possible answers, one of which was incorrect. Here's last week's question. What two things must a landlord do to bar a tenant's guest from coming onto the rental property? A. Give a written notice to the tenant's guest. B. Describe in the written notice the conduct complained of. Or C. Explain in the written notice the provisions of the lease or the law that were violated. The correct answers are B. Describe in the written notice the conduct complained of, and C. Explain in the written notice the provisions of the lease or the law that were violated. To bar a tenant's guest from coming onto the rental property, the landlord must give a written notice to both the tenant's guest and the tenant. Later in the show, we'll give you this week's quiz. Is that legal? For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussel.
It's time for this week's question and answer. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Please tell us your name and where you're from.
My name is Tamika, and I reside in North Richmond.
Thank you for being on the show. What question do we have this week?
In the event that there is an altercation between you and a neighbor where the police are called and you're referred back to your landlord, is that the correct thing to do?
In other words, what's the landlord's responsibility to deal with that situation?
Yes.
Well, that's a good question, Tamika, and we get that an awful lot at Legal Aid. Clearly, when you rent from a landlord, you're not responsible for the conduct of your neighbors, and you have no control over who your neighbor is going to be. So if you feel that you were not at fault and that it was your neighbor's fault if there was some sort of altercation or even some sort of problem, that they were the aggressor, you were defending yourself, or whatever the problem is simply their fault and not your fault, then your landlord has to deal with it. The same way your landlord has to deal with a problem of maintenance and repairs in your apartment, whether it is a dripping faucet or a broken window or anything like that. Really, the procedure for doing that is very similar to the procedure for dealing with a repair or maintenance issue. You've got to do three things. First, you have to be current in your rent and stay current. Secondly, you have to give written notice to the landlord about what the problem is. Now, in this case, the written notice wouldn't be about a dripping faucet or about a broken window. It would be about your neighbor's conduct, being as specific as you can be. Names and addresses, dates, times, and places, what your neighbor is doing, and why that poses a problem for you, and why this is not your fault. And then the third thing is you have to wait a reasonable period of time. So what the landlord can do during that reasonable period of time is either give notice to the neighbor that their behavior is causing you a problem and that they better stop it, or the landlord could go one step further and give the neighbor a notice to vacate based on the neighbor's conduct, and then if the neighbor doesn't voluntarily vacate, file a summons for unlawful detainer. If the problem persists after the notice period, you can take the next month's rent and the notice you gave the landlord and file a tenant's assertion in the general district court and pay your next month's rent into court. And what you're asking the judge to do is to order the landlord to do something about the problem. Or you can also ask the judge to allow you to end your lease, if that's what you want to do, and to move without penalty. The foreclosure crisis faced by the country 2 years ago has faded from public view, but the problems faced by struggling homeowners trying to keep their homes have not. A handful of foreclosure defense attorneys in Virginia continue to use and try to expand the legal tools available to keep borrowers in their homes. One of these is Karen Kennedy, a private attorney in Warrenton, Virginia, who recently spoke to Legal Aid about her innovative strategies, and the Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show was there. Here's the second part of this two-part presentation.
I am telling you about this for like another tool in y'all's arsenal, because if you want to modify the loan, if some people actually have the ability to modify the loan, a rescission letter and putting their feet to the fire about you have some knowledge that your documents are fraudulent and not correct is going to cause them to turn to you and go, what do you want? That has been my experience. And now, of course, as I'm sure you're all aware, HAMP has adjusted as of June 2nd to require the lenders to consider principal reductions. They call it PRA, principal reduction alternative. You have to be 15% underwater to get to apply for a PRA. They call it 115% mark to market, but the practical effect is you're 15% underwater. And you prove that, you get a broker's opinion letter, an appraisal. Most of them are fine with a broker's opinion letter, and that costs about $75 to $100. And you send in the HAMP modifications. I've had people come in and say, I didn't qualify for HAMP, and I read their hardship letter, and it sounds like, I say, you sound like you can't qualify to get up in the morning. You know, they're so pitiful, and the lender's not looking for that. Let me tell you what you, to get around loss mitigation, what I do is I send my registered letters with the rescission demand to their statutory registered agents. Also, I send it to the office of the president of the company. And I send all this registered mail return receipt. But sending it to the registered agent, you know, their job is to forward it to the counsel that they've been told to forward it to. So when they forward it to the counsel, all of a sudden you're having some attorney look at it instead of somebody in loss mitigation or somebody at the servicer level who doesn't care and doesn't understand. And you get some response. I mean, I've sent 3 HAMP modifications, and I've, of course, sent them to loss mitigation, and then I've sent them to the office of the president of Bank of America, and I've sent it to the registered agent. And I got 2 weeks ago, I got an email from a Virginia attorney at Shapiro and Burson who it had been sent to for pre-foreclosure, and he said, okay, Karen, what do you want? Another thing to delay foreclosure is send them a Fair Debt Collection Practices Act demand. They're required to suspend collection activity while they respond to that demand. Another thing I just started doing is I send notices to all the lenders that we are a party in interest in this deed of trust, and if they want to take any action with regards to the deed of trust, we demand that they register any trustees that they're going to have in the local jurisdiction as a trustee. What I'm running up against, I've tried to say, well, this trustee can't foreclose because they're not a Virginia entity. And the courts say, oh, no, they can, you know, they don't have to register to do business in Virginia. This isn't full-time doing business. This is just with this entity, which is a complete crock because all these outside substitute trustees are coming in here and doing hundreds of foreclosures. I mean, that's doing business in Virginia, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. But the statute says that if you're a party in interest, you can require, and the trustee is not a Virginia personal resident or a corporate resident, you can demand that they register before they foreclose. Virginia is very difficult. It just is so pro-bank and so pro-business and anti-consumer. I brought this case, Garcia versus GMAC Mortgage. The pleading was 108 pages. And then there were motions to dismiss and then Judge Lee's ruling, which I paid for the transcript. Essentially, Judge Lee said, he dismissed the case. He said, you haven't proved significant enough facts or alleged significant enough facts, and I don't believe you can prove them. You know, his discretion, I don't believe you can prove them, so I'm going to dismiss the case. But he alleged fraud, he alleged racketeering, he alleged that there was a class of people, which it is, and basically Judge Lee said, you don't have any specific facts. You have a pattern of activity that you say constitutes fraud and racketeering, but you don't have enough specific facts. This person did this, said this at such and such a time. And I think, you know, that's the problem. You have people that have shown up at settlement tables. They've had things pushed across the table at them to sign there. They have no idea what they're signing. And if you ask them for facts, they have no way to provide it to you.
You're listening to a presentation by private attorney Karen Kennedy about forensic mortgage loan and securitization audits. We'll be back in a moment. If you're just joining us, the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show now rejoins private attorney Karen Kennedy in a presentation about forensic mortgage loan and securitization audits.
What is happening is big banks are taking on these loans. And I'm just going to give you an example of one that I'm dealing with. Is IndyMac failed. The FDIC took it over. The FDIC closed IndyMac in June of 2008. So FDIC had the loan. They found a buyer. It's Deutsche Bank, trustee for IndyMac Series 2007-AB, whatever it is. So it's not a local bank. It's Deutsche Bank, who is the trustee for this pool of assets. They enter into a pooling and servicing agreement. The pooling and servicing agreement in Article 2 says that for a note to come into the PSA, it has to be an original note with all endorsements of all holders that have had it, or it has to be a true and accurate copy of the note, again with all the endorsements, and with a lost note affidavit from an officer of the last entity that had it. They are foreclosing left and right on notes that are not technically in the pooling and servicing agreement because they cannot produce that kind of note when they go to foreclose. One of the things that I thought about is, okay, we're not a party, but and the judges are saying entities to an agreement can violate their own agreement if they want to. They can waive the requirements of their agreement. And what I'm saying is, but doesn't the trustee have to go to all the holders of these certificates, all the people that have bought into this pool of assets, and get their approval to violate the agreement by trying to foreclose on a note that never formally came into the pooling and servicing agreement? Or does he have a power of attorney for everybody? So I discussed it with them, and their Maryland attorney filed a brief with the court basically saying that, and he hasn't ruled on it yet. They continued it over for trial till September. So how else can we use a securitization to benefit our clients? The loss share agreement pays a lender a lot more money than doing a HAMP modification. So if you have a securitization agreement with a loan, you can make the argument to them is it your loan is toxic. It's a predatory loan. Here's how we know. We've done an audit and you have all these violations and you could get sued and this loan could be rescinded. Or you could work with us, you could reduce the principal, you could give them a new loan, and then you can go back to the FDIC and say, hold your hand out and go, pay me the difference. So you all see that there's a big difference between them getting $3,000 because they've done a little modification of your loan and getting 20% of what loss they have. They only are losing 20%. They're getting 80% of it. It's a total scam, but they are getting paid on it. I agree. God forbid that FDIC would have to undertake all the servicing of these loans and all these requests, but it would balloon the federal government even more than it is now. But there is a guy out in Detroit, and he has been doing this for about a year. He has an attorney certified that the loan is toxic. He has a CPA detail what's wrong with the loan. And he has both a forensic audit for the TILA and RESPA violations and a securitization audit. But what you do is you contact the lender and say, we have a proposal to do, we have all of this stuff, and we have a proposal for you to be able, the loan is toxic, and for you to be able to access your loss share agreement with the FDIC if you modify this loan, and here's what we want. This guy has applied for 338 the last year, and he's gotten 334 of his loans. The principal's been reduced, and the average interest rate is about 3.5%. And we understand why it works so much better than a HAMP modification, because they're getting a lot of money. They don't have to hold the loan on their books. They turn a non-performing loan into a performing loan, and they can take it out of their their loss column and put it in their positive column, which makes their balance sheet look a lot better. The banks are seeing that this gravy train of pushing things to foreclosure is slowing down, that there people are fighting back and pushing back, and it's costing them more time and effort. And this going to them with a securitization audit and saying, you've got a toxic loan, you're able to access your loss share agreement, help us out. It's going to help you.
You've been listening to the second part of a two-part presentation by private attorney Karen Kennedy about forensic mortgage loan and securitization audits. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
It's time for our weekly quiz called, Is That Legal? We give you a legal question and three possible answers, one of which is incorrect, and we give the correct answers next week. If you're the first to email the two correct answers, we'll post your name on our show's website and send you a copy of the Virginia State Bar's Handbook on Your Legal Rights and Responsibilities. Here's this week's question. Which two recipients of temporary assistance for needy families do not have to participate in work requirements? A. Caretaker or relatives who are not the biological or adoptive parents of the children. B, disabled people, or C, all pregnant women? If you know the two correct answers, email them by Friday to marty@cvlas.org and be next week's winner. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Collaborative law is a new way to resolve family law disputes, where each party has a separate and specially trained attorney whose only job is to help the parties settle the case. Join us next week when Robin Edwards, managing attorney of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society in Charlottesville, discusses its brand new method of dispute resolution in a rebroadcast of a show originally heard on April 29, 2009. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.